recorded live in the Phantasmo Lounge high atop the R. Chetwin Haynes building in beautiful Midtown Portsmouth, Virginia. It's Phantasmo After Dark with your host, Rob Floyd. Tonight's topic, the Monster Club. Well, hey, everybody. Welcome to the lounge. It's just you and me tonight, this late night here in the lounge, and a couple stray cats roaming around. So if you hear some random weird noises, I'm not getting attacked. It's just a couple of cats roaming around causing a ruckus, if you will. You know, hey, the lounge is open to anybody. But hey, tonight's topic is really kind of an unusual little film that not a lot of people have seen. You may have heard of it, but you know, I haven't talked to a lot of people that have seen it over the years. And it's one that you know, deserves to be seen. It's kind of fun. It's kind of light, but it still has some creepy bits to it too. And I'm talking about The Monster Club. Now, you know, this is one of those anthology films like a lot of the ones that Amicus put out, like, you know, Tales from the Crypt, Vault of Horror, Dr. Terror's House of Horror, you know, there's quite a few of them. And whereas most of those were put out in the mid-70s, early 70s, all this was put out in 1981. So it's got a weird vibe to it. It's still, the stories still feel like that 70s kind of Amicus type stuff. Well, chiefly because Roy Ward Baker directed the whole thing. And this was actually his last film as a director. But in between the bits of the film, there's these musical numbers by these up-and-coming 80s pop bands, which, you know, you never heard of again after this, I don't think. But let me back up a little bit. Where Amicus is, a lot of people think of as Hammer Light. The Monster Club is Amicus Light. Not so much the horror stories, the three short stories in it are pretty good, but just the whole wraparound is very light in tone and almost is kind of supposed to be kind of comical. The movie starts off with Vincent Price and John Carradine. Well, that's reason enough right there to watch it regardless. And it's fun on two different levels. The individual stories are fun, and one of them is, like I said, quite creepy. And just watching the middle parts with Vincent Price and John Carradine kind of chewing a little scenery is worth the whole thing by itself. On the other hand, so you've got two different feelings going on, two different vibes going on throughout the whole movie. It goes back and forth. But neither one takes away from the other. The movie starts off with John Carradine is walking down the street, and it's obviously an indoor set. And you're talking, this is a very low-budget production for the wraparound scenes, anyway. And he gets approached by Vincent Price, who's this old guy who's claiming to be so hungry, he hasn't eaten in so long, and Carradine offers to help him out, and he says, thank you, and then he bites him. Vincent Price is a vampire. And I do believe this is the only film that he ever played a vampire in. Vincent Price always gets a reputation for being a monster actor and a horror actor, but he really hardly ever played any creatures. I mean, I think Dr. Fibes is really the most monstrous creature he ever played. You know, and then he's a vampire in this. So he bites him, and he only takes a little for a snack. He doesn't kill him. He doesn't turn him to a vampire. And in appreciation for letting him feed on him, he recognizes Carradine as supposedly this famous horror author. And Vincent Price is a big fan, so he offers to take him to the Monster Club where all the monsters kind of hang out. And he says he'll fit right in being such a, you know, famous horror author. So they go to the club, and it's really kind of goofy. There's all these, you know, people dancing to the music in monster masks. And I don't know where these masks came from. They're not Don Post masks. They're not from any company that I can recall ever seeing in my travels looking around, you know, for memorabilia and stuff. They could have been specially made for the movie. Probably were. I don't know. And some of them are pretty cool. Some of them are a little goofy. But there's no costumes, really. They're just wearing these monster masks and regular clothes. And all these people dancing around. And the camera's moving in and out. And then it goes back to the table where they're sitting. And they get drinks. And Vincent Price is going to tell John Carradine some stories about his fellow monsters. So he'll understand what these people, what these monsters are like. And there's this chart conveniently on the wall, like a family tree of the different types of monsters, and Vincent Price goes through that, and then he stops on one, and that's the first story. The first story is about a creature called a Shadmock, and he explains what type of creature it is, and it really, the guy really doesn't look very monstrous. He just looks like an old goth kid who never grew out of being goth, with the page boy kind of hairdo and dark circles around his eyes. which is just kind of weird when the first person that meets him and we see him, she kind of is repulsed and runs away. And it's like, what? He just looks like a creepy old guy. He doesn't look that scary. But the story goes, he lives alone in this mansion and doesn't go out because of the way he looks. And he hires this girl to help him collects antiques to catalog his big collection. Well, this girl and her boyfriend decide that they want to try to fleece him for, steal some of his money or his antiques. So she works there for a while, trying to find as much as she can about him. And she ends up kind of not falling for him, but having a lot of sympathy for him and doesn't want to do it. Her boyfriend convinces him. The Shadmak starts to fall for her and ask her to marry him. And the boyfriend convinces her to do it. And they'll steal all his stuff. And, I'm not going to tell you how it ends, but it ends badly for her. And not too good for him either. But the thing about him that makes him a monster pretty much is if he whistles, he has this whistle that it will destroy things, whatever he focuses on. Like, he whistles in the garden at this cat that attacked a bird that he was feeding, and the cat just kind of burst into flames and disintegrated. So that's what makes him a monster. It's actually a good little story. It's well acted. It does not look low budget like the interim bits in between the stories. It's a neat little story. It's, maybe, 15, 20 minutes long. And then we go back to Vincent Price and John Carradine. And I'll talk about those little bits in a minute and with the music and all. But the next story is more of a lighthearted vampire story where this guy is talking to his family. Britt Eklund's in it, and Donald Pleasence is the vampire hunter in this part of the vampire hunter squad. And the guy's saying goodnight to his family. The little boy's going to bed, and he says, Dad, why can't you play with me during the day? And he says, I have to go to work at night, son. And the son doesn't know he's a vampire at this point. And we don't really know either quite yet, I don't think. But he goes off to work, and then the next day the kid's at school, and he's kind of a loner kid. The kids pick on him all the time and, kind of nerdy and stuff. And then Donald Pleasence, masquerading as a vicar, tries to befriend the boy to get information about his dad. And he goes home, and he's all down because he got picked on. And the mother, is it the mother that tells him? Anyway, somebody tells him. I can't remember. Maybe it's the mother. Don't be sad. Those boys, you're better than them. Your father's a count from the old country, and he had to move here to, and they're in England at this point for work and all this stuff. He's a count, so that makes you a viscount, and you're better than them, so don't let them make you feel down. So the next day, he's getting picked on again, and of course, then he has to tell them, I'm better than you, you don't bother me, I'm a viscount, and of course, they pick on him more for that. Donald Pleasence ends up walking the boy home, and then gets into the house, and down in the basement, and ends up staking the father in the coffin. The boy and the mother see this, and they, of course, gasp in horror, but as he stakes the vampire leans up and bites Donald Pleasence. So now he's going to become a vampire. So his guys that are with him are running around through the basement trying to stake him, and they stake him, and he dies. And Britt Eklund and the boy come back down the steps and they're grieving. And the vampire sits up and says, "Ha ha! I was wearing a stake-proof vest loaded with ketchup packets." So he's alive, and it's a happy ending. And that's a cute, light little story. Then it goes back, of course, to a music bit and Vincent Price and John Carradine. And then the last story is actually the creepiest one. This one's pretty good, and this is Stuart Whitman is playing an American film director, and he's in London, and they can't find any locations he's satisfied with, so he's going to go off and try to find a small village out in the middle of nowhere, trying to find locations for himself for this movie. Well, he ends up coming upon this little village, and he thinks it's perfect. It's really old and run down looking, and looks like hardly anybody's living there, and there's a few people, and they're acting kind of weird, and he tries to get a room at this inn, and people are really strange and almost zombie-like. And he finds out the little girl who brings him dinner in his room, tells him what's going on. And the town apparently, and she has a weird speech pattern, like really like she's very uneducated, The town was beset years and years ago by this band of ghouls who ended up killing all the men and eating them and having sex with all the women, mating with the women. And then, I guess, turn around and eating them, and after the children were born anyway. And, of course, so now it's a generation of ghouls and, as she says, Hume ghoul, which is a hybrid of human and ghoul. And it's really creepy because as this unfolds to Stuart Whitman, she says something, oh, you're from the city, you dress like that all the time. He says, yeah. He says, you know, don't you have, you know, any other clothes? And she says, only what we get from the boxes. And so, yeah, we get food from the boxes, we get our clothes from the boxes, and this and that from the boxes. And as it goes on, you find out the boxes are coffins that they've dug up. They dig up the graves to eat what's in the boxes, the people that are in the boxes, and they take the get their clothes and everything off of them first. So they get everything from the boxes. Well, all the boxes are now empty. They've dug up all the graves, so Stuart Whitman is next. He befriends the girl, and she tells him that, well, if you want to get out and be safe, you know, they won't go in the church. Go over to the church. So he goes over to the church, and he convinces her to come along with him to get out of there, and they run. She, of course, gets killed along the way. He makes it out to the highway, and he flags down a police car, and they get him in the car, and they say, okay, we'll take you. And they go down the road, make a U-turn, and go back up towards the village. And he's like, wait, what are we doing? We're going to the village. And they're part of the ghouls. They're just, it doesn't explain why they're on the police force, but they're part of the village, and they bring him back, and that's kind of how it ends. You know, he's going to die. It's a lot creepier than I made it out to be telling you this. But that's probably the best story of the whole bunch of the three on there, because it kind of, the mood that the other ones set, this one goes a little darker, and especially with all the in-between bits, it's pretty good. It really is very creepy, and really, you know, I'd recommend watching this really, really late at night to really get a feel for it. Now, the in-between bits, on the other hand, you know, as I said before, it's, you know, you got John Carradine and Vincent Price together. That's gold right there. That's worth watching alone. And their bits is just them talking back and forth, you know, not overacting, not, you know, not really chewing scenery too much. So that's pretty good. But the other stuff in there, like I said, well, the people dance around the mask is just, it's like, yeah, we're cutting corners on the budget here. We spent all our money on the names in the cast, like Price and Carradine, Donald Pleasant, Stuart Whitman, Britt Eklund, Simon Ward is in it. And oh, and the people they approached earlier, well, before they made the movie for some of the parts that turned it down, they wanted to get Christopher Lee and Peter Cushing for the Vincent Price and Carradine roles, but they both turned it down. But, you know, Vincent Price and Carradine were like, nope, we'll take it. Paycheck, right on. So, and the movie's not any worse for wear because of them. But the other stuff, the music in it. Now, the only band that I have heard of, UB40 is on the soundtrack, and some of their music is in the movie, but they don't appear in the film at all. But there's other bands that do appear and, you know, play a whole song. They're, boom, right on the film. In between the stories is The Pretty Things, a band called Night, The Viewers. Yeah, I think, oh God, I forgot. There's one guy at the beginning. But some of the songs to look out for are Monsters Rule Okay. That's kind of the theme. That's the first song you hear, and then it's a reprise at the end. And then Sucker for Your Love. Get that vampire? Sucker, you get it? Okay. And then The Stripper, which has nothing to do with horror or anything in the movie, but they make it horror. The song goes on, and there's, of course, The Stripper. And then this girl comes out and starts to strip. And when she gets down to where she has to take more off to where you completely see her naked, she goes behind this curtain. And there you don't see any nudity at all. She goes behind a curtain, and you see a silhouette. Well, all of a sudden, it becomes animated. It's pretty slick the way it's done, though. And then she starts to peel off, like, looks like she's going to peel off a sleeve, and she peels off her skin, and there's, like, skeleton arm bone there. And then she does the other arm that way. And then her legs and her torso and her head. And then so it's a skeleton of this behind the screen. And that was kind of cool. That was a neat little unexpected bit. And it was done really well. The music, man, it's so early 80s. If you know, are into the pop music from the 80s, from that era, if you grew up in there at any time, it really changed radically from the early 80s to the late 80s and even the mid 80s through all the pop stuff and the hair metal and everything else. The very early 80s, the first couple of years up to about 82, 83 was really an odd period, and that music is really unique unto itself. A lot of the stuff that came out right around that time, it doesn't sound like a lot of the stuff that's typically associated with the 80s later on, and this stuff is a kind of a prime example of that by bands you've never heard of. But some of the songs are kind of fun. Like, The Monsters Rule OK is a goofy kind of song, but it's, you know, is what it is for this movie. And Sucker For Your Love's got a catchy hook to it. And, you know, like I said, these bands got this, they got this shot in this movie and boom. And then, I don't know, The Pretty Things, I think I may have heard of. And, you know, hey, if you've heard of these bands and they went on to do something, I don't know about it, let me know. Drop us a line at the email, the Phantasmo After Dark email. That's phantasmoad@gmail.com. Or just throw a message down on the Phantasmo After Dark Facebook page. You know, be just as good. And I'm going to try to throw, of course, I'll throw the trailer up and maybe a couple clips. Maybe I'll, if I can get the songs isolated, if I can find those, I'll throw some links up to those. But I'll definitely put some pictures up from all the stories and everything. It's really interesting. The movie, it's, the short stories in it really feel like an Amicus film. And like I said before, it's Roy Ward Baker, and then a lot of the people that were in some of the other Amicus films are in those. And they feel like there were maybe more in the 70s. And the music, again, like I said, is definitely this early 80s, new wave, pop kind of feel to it. Except for the stripper, that's more of a pop, hair metal-ish kind of, but not really, tune. So you've got this juxtaposition, I guess, is what I'm trying to say, of the 80s and the 70s, like, both trying to fight for their spot here. And it's almost kind of hard to tell when was this movie made. But I guess that really does cement it in being in 1981, or, you know, at least 80, 81, you would guess. Because a lot of stuff, there's quite a few things that people associate with the 70s that were still didn't come out until 80, 81. Chief among them is The Wall. Pink Floyd's The Wall, the movie, I think that did come out in 80, but everybody will swear it came out, you know, who hadn't paid attention to when it came out will swear that it came out in the 70s. That's because the 70s were, you know, still lingering a little bit in 80. Whereas the 60s, I always say the 60s didn't really end until about 71 or so. And each decade is like that. It's the remnants of them kind of linger into the coming decade, and the coming decade doesn't really obtain its identity as that decade until a few years in. And then, boom, everything about it screams of that decade. And a lot of people say the 60s didn't end until the Beatles broke up. And I guess, was that 70, I think? But I think the 60s went on a little bit longer. The whole sensibility and everything, 70s didn't really come about until 72, 73, like that, and then that was the 70s. But this movie is a lot of fun, and if you can find it, I was looking it up the other day. I have a copy myself I got many years ago. I think I got it when Best Buy still, like, carried a lot of good DVDs and stuff and was worth going in. Nah, it's a total crap store. They don't have anything worth a damn DVD-wise. They used to have an incredible selection of DVDs and obscure stuff. You could go there and always find something. I would go every week. Once a week, I would go into Best Buy and look for stuff and buy a DVD or two. But, nah, just not worth it anymore. They just nothing to choose from. But I believe I got this one way back then anyway. And I don't know what I paid for it. It couldn't have been more than 10, 15 bucks, something like that. Now, though, I don't know if it's out of print, but it's not real easy. Well, it's not real cheap. The cheapest copy I saw was around 25 bucks on Amazon. Yeah, you can look on eBay. You might be able to find it a little cheaper. I'm not sure if it's on Blu-ray or not, but, you know, you can dig around and see. It's a fun little film. It's, if you like these anthology films, and I really like them, and I really get in the mood to see one out again, and, like, you know, like I said, Vault of Horror, Tales from the Crypt, etc. This is one, especially if you haven't seen it, you need to add it to your collection. You need to, or at least watch it one time. It's fun, and it's creepy, and it goes back and forth, but the historical aspect of it, of the time it came out, and this crossing of this leaving the 70s going into the 80s within this one film, it's kind of neat. Again, I'll just go back to, anytime Vincent Price is on screen, it's gold. And John Carradine to the mix, it's a lot of fun. One thing really interesting about this film, though, is it was never released theatrically in the United States. What you say? Yes. It was it was released in England in 81. And it was covered in, I think, and Famous Monsters did a whole big thing. I remember having an issue of Famous Monsters that had that chart that you'll see on the wall, either on the first page or on the inside cover. I remember having an issue that had that chart in it. And of course, they covered the movie like it was coming out. It was supposed to come out. And for one reason or another, it did not get released in the United States, not theatrically, but in 82, it was released on TV, Shock Theater packages or whatever. Or I think Elvira, it later on, she showed it and it got some interest. And of course, I probably saw it on Dr. Mad Blood one time back then. I'm almost sure I did. And it was released also, this is interesting, well, like I said, it was kind of an independent kind of film. I can't remember the name of the company that released it. It's not one I ever heard of, but it was distributed by ITC, Incorporated Television Company, or ITC Entertainment. That's the same company that you know, distributed The Muppet Show to the United States and everything. So there you go. I would recommend this. Look it up. Find it. If you can get a copy, if you want to pay $25 for it, by all means. It's not going to be a waste of money. You're not going to... I don't think it's there's nothing about it to hate. The stories are good. There's a creepy one. There's a light funny one. There's kind of and the first one is serious in tone and is just a straight, well done kind of gothic kind of story. And the in between bits are a lot of fun. And if you have a nostalgic affection for the 80s, the musical bit and these bands, you'll like that aspect of it too. This is going to be a pretty short one tonight because, it's just me here rambling on about this film. Nobody to bounce anything off of. But I did want to put this one out there. Did want to talk about this a little bit because it's one that, like I said earlier, you don't really hear about this one too much. It doesn't get lumped in with the other anthology films that are like this. And it's a shame because it's a good one. It's fun. Is it in my top three favorites of anthology films? I don't know, but I definitely would watch it again and watch it again with some people just to see them watch it because it's the 80s aspect of it. The music is something in this. And I think that's about it. That's about all I've got. This is going to be a real short one tonight. Hopefully we'll have some guest hosts coming up. I've got some feelers out to some friends and we'll have some return guest hosts that you've heard here before and maybe a couple of new folks that we haven't chatted with yet. So we'll see what's coming up. Always keep checking back with us. Check the Phantasmo After Dark Facebook page. Drop us a line. Let us know if you listen. Let us know if you like it. Let us know if you don't like it. That's cool too. Tell me to go to hell. I don't care. Just as long as you're listening, that's cool. That's it for the Monster Club tonight for this episode. So on behalf of me and the stray cats here roaming around, thanks for listening, everybody. Good night.